All right, so I'm gonna go ahead. If people come in, I'll just have them take their red handout. First, I'm Bonnie Miller McLemore, and I thought it might be helpful to just say a little bit about me and what I'm hoping to do today and some of the other sessions the rest of the week to sort of set a framework. I think if you heard Mark, you know we've been married 33 years, and we have three sons, one of whom spent a year here, now 27, 24, and 22. And I've taught for, it's so hard for me to believe, I think, oh my gosh, it's like, but 27 years. My oldest was 9 months when I started teaching. And I started first at Chicago Theological Seminary for about 9 years, and then I moved to Vanderbilt University Divinity School and have been there 18, which also feels like, is that possible? And you will see the influence. I've written books that preceded the book that shaped this session, but and you will see the influence of my family and living in a family context on some of what I have to share with you. Yeah, there's handouts, and I don't know if I've got enough, but if you didn't get one, come in. And I'll explain what I'm doing with that in a second.
Hey, hello, everybody. Thank you.
I was just sort of setting a framework, telling people a little about who I am and how I came to this. And I teach, just so again, to pick up to where I was, I teach pastoral care to students going into ministry. And I also, the nice thing about being at Vanderbilt is there's also a PhD program, so I teach doctoral students who will teach ministry students in the area of religion, psychology, and culture. So that's kind of what I do that's behind this session. But that helps you know me a little bit better. I think of the aim of this session as sort of giving you fresh ways to think about spirituality and faith that push back against what I will describe as the received tradition, how we stereotype spirituality. And some of that just comes directly out of my own life experience, as well as a lot of digging around in the resources that I've done.
What's your definition of spirituality?
I kind of use spirituality and faith interchangeably. Connection to the transcendent, to the divine, a sense of God's presence. Is that enough to kind of help us go forward? I could also say this is a session really on how we think about the life of faith, the practice of faith in our lives.
Thank you.
And my plan, if you look at the handout, is to sort of break up what I have to say into four parts. There are five here, but the first two are really together. And I just want to talk to you about and let you kind of hear with me some of the issues that I ran into as a parent and a full-time worker. And then I'll pause and see what thoughts and you can interview before then, and then I'll do a little on some responses to this problem that I ran into when I described on the my description of today's session, just some of the fruit, some of the things I discovered that were of great comfort and solace to me. And if that's all as far as we get, that's fine. I would love to get to number four, which is, in that section, I really want to talk about some of the resources in the Protestant tradition that we tend to forget, including Luther. Not a Lutheran, but really that subtitle of my session, What a Friend We Have in Luther. I think Luther was urging a different way of thinking about faith and spirituality that we forget, that has shaped and should shape the Protestant tradition more fully. And then finally, my last, number five, is just to give you other ways to think in your own lives about the everyday practice of Christian faith. Again, that push back against some of this recent tradition. So, to start with just a small epiphany in my own life, And some of this is coming straight from a book, In the Midst of Chaos, Care of Children as Spiritual Practice. And even though this book is about care of children and parents, and you'll hear me talk about parents and children, I do think I'm trying to rethink faith for anyone who has a full life of service with dependencies in relationships that they care for. My epiphany, or one of several, but occurred several years ago when my children were really small and I was doing a quintessential act of multitasking. I had a couple in the bathtub and I was actually reading a book I assigned for class. I was watching my kids, but I was trying to read Henry Nouwen's Sayings of the Desert Fathers, because I had assigned it to a ministry class in pastoral care and also wanted to enliven my own practices of faith. Now, what does Henry say in this? Drawing on one of the desert fathers, Abbot Asinius, Nouwen, the author of the book on the desert fathers, names three things as essential to faith, to spirituality: solitude, silence, and prayer. Flee society, be silent, and pray. There I was, three children under six, and a full-time job, and silence and solitude were rare. There were times, no doubt, that I wanted to flee, or at least some of the daily duties, at least. But I couldn't, or at least not to the extent that Nouwen implied. And there were also times when I yearned for silence, and needed silence. But the message I was taking away from this book, without silence or solitude, was I able to experience God. These ancient sources and modern spiritual guides didn't seem to be saying so. And I also found myself thinking, is this the message I wanted to convey to my ministry students, who would likely become hardworking ministers and perhaps parents themselves, and who might then convey it to their parishioners, many of whom would be in my own position? My youngest son was playing with words and drew me back from my reading, and another thought crystallized. Why were silence and solitude so absolutely crucial? Although helpful and important, and I would not want to throw them out, were they sufficient unto themselves? And I looked up from Nouwen's lines about the danger of wordiness as sinful, and to see one of my sons, not much over a year, playing with words and seeing him empowered by words, that they opened up worlds for him. They were a source of self-knowledge, meaning, and power, even learning the word no. That's a two-year-old, one-and-a-half-year-old. Certainly words in this book that I was reading, quote, lead to sin, as the Desert Fathers say. But silence, I was thinking, can also lead to exploitation and stagnation. And words can build a home. So his words, I think, confirmed to me the place of conversation next to silence, and connection alongside solitude as important for faithful living. So that's the problem. Inadvertently, I had stumbled upon a problem that other parents and certainly scholars before me had suspected. Whether you realize it or not, the church has a long history that we still live with. That Janet Soskus is the person who calls the received tradition of prizing monastic aesthetic spirituality over the spirituality of marriage, family, relationships. Just to tell a couple other stories about this problem that were helpful for me to hear. One comes from Janet Soskus herself, and she talks, I'm just going to read a quote from her. When a young, exhausted Anglican mother found her devotional life in disarray after the birth of her child, Soskus reports that the mother received this advice from three priests. Quote, the first told her that if the baby woke at 6 a.m., she should rise at 5 a.m. for a quiet hour of prayer. The second asked if her husband could not arrange to come home early from work 3 times a week so she could get to Mass. I'm like, no reactions yet, okay. This advice, I'm still reading from Sossus, this advice proved threatening to life and marriage. The third told her, quote, relax and just look after your baby. The rest of the church is praying for you. Anyone who has had children knows how difficult the first suggestion, that is getting up a little early. First of all, as if babies keep some kind of regular schedule and parents have the energy to get up. Most parents also know how much the second idea, negotiating for more child-free time and much less time for prayer, can disrupt a relationship or even tear a relationship apart. The third suggestion actually was clearly meant to comfort and is the best of the three suggestions and is one I actually see the value of. That is, the church has pledged to pray and care for children and parents. But underneath, the remark also implies that the faith life of a busy parent is simply on hold, or in Saskia's words, Christians on idle, taking some years off from their faith life while others seek God on their behalf. So a second person I bumped into who's really written well on this, and by the way, on the back, somebody said they love handouts, on the back of your handout are resources, other books, other people who've written. And so another person, Wendy Wright, who's a Catholic scholar and church historian, she was helpful for me because she lifted up, and she, I think coming out of the Catholic tradition, talked about the received tradition in this way. In her words, few of the great remembered prayers, the people who are lifted up as good prayers, were married. Few had children. And in fact, many of the esteemed champions of the people who have become saints, few of them, they model an entirely different way of life than the life of most of us. They pursue God through silence and solitude, and without, sort of with the mobility of an unattached life. They try to love all dispassionately rather than particular persons. And sometimes they radically cut ties with families and forsake the satisfaction of bodily need and sexual desire. Ardent devotion of God required the transcending of the body, voluntary poverty, pilgrimage away from the boundaries of home. What Wright helps us see is there's a huge gulf between this pattern and daily life for most of us. Passionate attachment to specific people, perhaps marriage and children, immersion in bodily sexual activity, commitment to one location, ownership and care of material possessions, and the daily grind of making a living and maintaining a home, all very different from this life that has been held up. Unfortunately, behind this, and this is sort of my third point under the problem, behind this ideal that we may think no longer permeates our perceptions of faith and spirituality, lies within the Christian tradition itself, I think distinctly to the New Testament over against the Jewish tradition, is a deep ambivalence about the family that is less true of the Jewish tradition out of which Christianity emerged. So you have in the Synoptic Gospels, just to describe this ambivalence, and you'll be familiar when I describe it, you have Jesus disclaiming his own biological family and proclaiming a new family of believers, not related by birth, but by commitment to God's will. And certainly you can bring to mind other passages that, the reason why I use the word ambivalence is there's also appreciation for marriage within and family within the New Testament scriptures. These passages weren't meant to negate the value of family. In fact, we could read them as a critique of the extended family clan and its assertion of power and authority, rather than a dismissal of marriage and procreation. So there are passages like the blessing of wedding wine, or the welcoming of children, or the forbidding of divorce, that reflect a positive appraisal. But there still is this ambivalence, and you see both in Jesus' model of discipleship he was single, without children, and he asked those who followed him to leave their family. Likewise, the Apostle Paul never married or had children, and he really did write out of a sense of the imminence of God's kingdom. So he advised against changing your situation and becoming married. And this may even relate to Mark's work with the scriptural passages of Paul and the idea of community. He has this wonderful phrase about the Christian community as the household of God. So Christians were creating new families and new understandings of households and families. So we have this ambivalent tradition, and it is within the Christian tradition itself. And it has led us to these typical perceptions of faith, that faith happens sort of outside ordinary times, on the mountaintop, internal to one's own individual soul. And this, you know, still pervades our perceptions of what faith means. I'm not trying to rule out silence or solitude. In fact, academic faculty have lots of silence and solitude. It's partly what perhaps attracted me to what I do. I need a lot of time undivided and focused. I simply am trying, as I was saying, my aim in this first session, to widen the circle of faith to include those with a full life of service and relationship and relational commitments. I think there is within the Christian tradition other traditions. Ignatius would be one, and Benedict of Nyssa would be a second, both in the Catholic tradition, that try to wed contemplation and action, or try to create communities of contemplation and commitment. But there's a fewer number of people, myself included, that have really tried to think about rethinking faith in light of families and deep relational commitments. I think there is a bias against what I would call these outward material forms of faith and spirituality enacted in the body, in the midst of families and community. And it marginalizes a lot of people, these way we think about faith. So I'm basically saying we need fresh ways to think about spirituality that is more inclusive. So I'm going to stop, and this is before going to some responses, and sort of ask if have I captured a problem that some of the rest of you have experienced? And you know, as you think about that, another connection I'm wanting to make is back to Sunday scripture and the Mary and Martha stories. And I really agree with Becky that we've just created a really not fruitful dichotomy in how we perceive Martha. So one section in the early chapters of In the Midst of Chaos is titled Redeeming Martha. There's not a lot in the tradition that redeems Martha. And I found one figure whose name I can never pronounce, Meister Eckhart. Did I get that close enough? And he has Stephanie Paulsell, another colleague who teaches at Harvard, is really to be credited with digging out his words of praise for Martha. His interpretation, Eckhart's interpretation, is that Jesus is really worried about Mary, that Mary does not have her act together, and Martha has already mastered management of household and care of others, and is well advanced in her faith rather than Martha. Which, I mean, we can hardly even believe that. And I mean, when I heard the scripture on Sunday, there is a line where I'd like to know biblical scholars, you know, where did that line come from? Where he, I think that Jesus is said to have said by Luke, and we have to remember we've got an author writing this to, with his own purposes, that Mary has chosen the better way. And so Eckhart somehow gets around that and is really saying, no, he's worried about Mary, and Martha is modeling house management. So thoughts on the problem before I kind of move to some responses. Have I tapped into something that bothers anybody else?
Yeah, well, the most bothersome thing to me historically is that the contemplative life has been based upon the freedom of an elite, even when the elite is a huge segment of the population, as it was in the Middle Ages, to have the leisure to have contemplation. And that's the most troubling thing for me. In the same way, there is a sexism to this history that allows a majority of men to have the monastic contemplative life. Women can do it, but it's been much more of a minority. The sisters were always nursing, teaching, doing many, many service things to earn the right to have the monastic time, to have the contemplative time.
That's really helpful. What I really like that you're saying is the word elite. I think if you read my bio, my little blurb, I think one of the things that I have felt has been a call for me is challenging the elitism of spirituality and theology. That theology needs also to be given back to the people. Not that there shouldn't be experts who read and think and spend time and nourish the tradition. But I really appreciate your just even using that word, because I think what happens is that it really impoverishes the richness of the wider community's engagement in faith. And that's why when I get to the section on Luther, I think he was also challenging a certain hierarchical elite portrait of the religious life, and it's really important here. And another thing I want to say too about sexism is, yes, I think one other metaphorical story I tell is the contrast between, and this dates the book when I was writing it, but seeing C.S. Lewis's film, was it called The Homeland? Or anyway, C.S. Lewis is sitting in his office, you know, being served tea.
Yeah.
And I thought, well, no wonder he could write brilliant. You know? Yeah, I mean, I didn't have a life. Nobody, you know, was supporting, and I still have, in some ways, a richly privileged life academically. Contrasted that with Parenthood, a movie that came out around the same time, where, I don't know if you've seen this movie, but, you know, the parents are riding home from a sporting event, and the kids are, I mean, it's just in the midst of chaos, and, you know.
Diarrhea.
I think that's right. They're singing, what, diarrhea? Or, you know, I mean, it's just like, it's such a portrait of how do parents sustain their sanity, much less their spiritual life. And in some ways, I'm saying, we have to find some ways to rethink what spiritual life is for folks like that, which is most of us. Yeah, Rachel and then Bonnie. And
yeah, one thing that came up for me is just thinking about how hardworking my family is in their like tradition, and it's a very much part of their culture. So in I don't see a lot of necessity for redeeming Martha, because I think that's the revered, I mean, if you like the capitalism and the Protestant work ethic, you know, I feel like my extended family kind of lives into that real ideal of working really, really hard, and that's the most important thing. And so I'm kind of contrasting that, but I don't, but I do think that's kind of more their cultural tradition, and there still is this idea, you know, or there was at least definitely for my parents and grandparents' generation, that Sunday was the day where you contemplate, and my family, you know, rebelled against that a little bit, but that was their tradition, where Sundays you weren't supposed to do anything, you know, except maybe read the Bible, but, you know, there, you weren't supposed to play outside, you weren't supposed to do that, and so there was a real strict, so I think that was kind of their way of revering hard work, and also revering this contemplative, like, ideal, so I think they tried to do it in that way, and I certainly don't see that for myself the same way, but, so I do see some of both, I think.
Definitely.
When you read the Nouwen quote, just that little one about silence, that's what I heard was him saying that is the heart of Christianity. And that just contrasts so much with our session just a couple hours ago with Mark that was all about community. But community is really the heart of Christianity, not being apart and being silent and, you know, it's about community. So really that's just two different, I presume it kind of makes a whole if we need to acknowledge both, but it struck me as kind of odd.
Yeah, I think keeping both in perspective and in relationship to each other, if we use both being silence and conversation or connection and solitude. And it's interesting, again, maybe it is partly the faith tradition that has formed both Mark and I, but a correlation I see between what he was talking about, and I hadn't seen it until I was sitting in a session and then thinking about this one, that in both, he's saying something similar to what I'm saying, which is we can be deeply formed by our community relationships in really deep spiritual ways. And maybe let me go to the next section on some responses, where I will talk about, you know, what does it mean to attend or to do laundry as a spiritual practice and how that forms us. I remember when I stumbled across the words of medievalist scholar Elizabeth Dreyer, she completely reversed the usual characterization of the drudgery of parenting as lost spiritual time, idle time, until you could get back to doing good for others, get back to the soup kitchen, get back to all the things that we should be doing, that your, you know, care of others, particularly children, demand. She describes caring for kids, and this is her words, the aesthetic opportunity par excellence. I'm going to unpack this. Traditionally, asceticism refers to disciplines of self-denial, word renunciation, such as celibacy or fasting, in order to draw closer to God. She turns this completely upside down, and she says, if you regard it from the right angle, a parent's daily life, and I want you to generalize this to anyone's full life, the life that we are all leading this week, busily trying to help remediate a village, has an oddly haunting resemblance to the aesthetic life. And these are her words. Unbidden, unexpected opportunity arises for a similar kind of disciplined religiosity. And in one sentence, she captures, at least in the parent's life cycle, a different image. A full night's sleep, time to oneself, the freedom to come and go as one pleases. All this must be given up. Huge chunks of life are laid down on the behest of infants. And then later, she says, parents must let go. So she's captured the whole life cycle, and she said that itself is an aesthetic discipline that shapes us and forms us and can form us in the Christian life. We can see it as forming us. I cannot say how relieved I felt when I first came across these words several years ago. They allowed me to see my own early parenting as somehow connected to my faith. The first question, just as sort of to make this real, that we often ask new parents is, how many hours does she sleep? Or, is she sleeping through the night? Are you getting any sleep? And now I see on one level, this is a deeply spiritual question. It's about faith, care, and sustaining oneself in the practices of love, even if this dimension goes unnoticed. Wendy Wright, the person I was talking about before, who is a busy leader of spiritual retreats, she reads and writes extensively on spiritual disciplines, she's a religion professor and spiritual director, and yet, when she writes about spirituality, she says, all these roles have shaped me, but motherhood has most profoundly formed me. And she's not using formation lightly here. She is talking about formation as it's been classically defined by the Christians and the world's spiritual traditions. This is her definition. I think it's helpful, maybe finally getting back to your opening question about what spirituality is. She's defining formation as conscious engagement in a series of spiritual practices that enable one to emerge as a transformed person, which for Christians means putting off the old person, alienated from God, and becoming new in Christ. Just a couple examples. Let me first do the one on attending, the spiritual discipline of just paying attention, and then on laundry. So a really common pattern in the care of children could be seen as something that can bring us closer to Christ. So some people, including Janet Soskus, have looked to the spiritual practice of attention that happens in almost a rudimentary way with parents of young children, looking for what, this is Soskus' words, the innumerable acts of watchfulness, many almost as involuntary as lactation, Soskus says. So parents of toddlers, for example, scan any new surrounding for steps, breakable, sharp, swallowable objects, and move to protect their kids. We don't think about this much when we do it, but we do it all the time. And in some ways, parents see more, Soskus says, or they're more fully there. She also goes on to say that some acts of this kind of attention require a disciplined, conscious exercise of humility. So to attend to a child properly, you have to sort of employ the proper passivity of letting the other be. This is Soskus's words. So ideally, acts of attention sort of strengthen a love that doesn't clutch or cling to the beloved, but lets the child grow. And by such means, at least once in a while, parents become unselved or unselfed, in Soskus's words, and are drawn out in genuine attention to the other. I think this discipline or practice of attention becomes more arduous as children grow and into youth and young adults and move out of our proximity and demand even a more highly tuned decision about when to intervene, when to stand back, and allow children greater responsibility for their lives. But it remains a formative discipline that transforms us. What about laundry? To take just another very different example. Here I ran across Kathleen Norris's work. And some of you have maybe read her spiritual memoir, Dakota, and others that she's published since then. But she published a really small essay in the New York Times about, quote, the joys of hanging clothes on the line to dry. And she really probably received more letters than she ever had for anything else in response. Except for one tired mother with small children and a long commute who claimed that Norris must have way too much time on her hands, it seemed that the recognition of the holy in the mundane of doing laundry had struck a chord. And I think, in some ways, I think Norris acknowledges it's important to heed the one letter of protest about glorifying domestic work. But I still think Norris's claim that and these are her words in her book, that women's work can ground us, laundry could can ground us, laundry. Rebecca will appreciate this. Rather than grind us down, she subtitles a book, which the main title is The Quotidian Mysteries, the book on the daily, the ordinary, the commonplace, Laundry, Liturgy, and Women's Work. And it's really a wonderful, of course, laundry can be brain numbing, and there is little in life that's pure faith or pure joy or pure love. But in a way, she's arguing that doing laundry as other quotidian aspects of life can form us. The symbolic or the material can merge in these acts. One of my friends, a mother of twins, told me she once found herself crying over a huge pile of unfolded clothes. She cried as she folded, both out of frustration that her husband refused to help, and out of recognition that her days of being so close to her children's underwear were short-lived and fleeting. So my sense is that these daily acts can form us in ways that we sometimes underestimate. Does this provide any comfort for some of you? Yeah.
Sorry, I know it's a little off topic, but just as a quick comment, it'd be nice if laundry could not be referred to as women's work, because I definitely enjoy hanging laundry on the line and also folding.
That's right.
It soothes my conscience when I see my wife doing women's work.
It should. I think in some ways, maybe Norris isn't attentive enough to that to say that a lot of, and I think what she is trying to do is redeem domestic work for everyone as deeply important to honoring the households we live in. I mean, I've also talked to people who see cleaning and really caring for what your surroundings as, potentially an act of real faith and commitment. And it should be shared more justly and equally. It should never have been women's work. We have too many centuries of it being seen that way.
I guess I would also speak up to the fact that it isn't always a situation where you have a couple. And you can have a situation where it is a single parent, and it's not always a woman.
Yeah.
So it's somewhat disconcerting to be focused solely that direction when the reality is you are a parent. And that's the responsibility that everything else permeates from.
Yeah, definitely. Rachel?
Well, I feel like Holden has been a place that has really taught me joy and honoring the hard work of everyone. You know, I really appreciate that here, and I've seen it in a couple other places where there's been a real sense of equality around work, and I think that's an important aspect of it. But to see, you know, the kitchen work and the housekeeping work as important as, you know, the log splitting and the maintaining the utilities and stuff that I don't know how to do, you know, to really honor the work of every person and to have every person participate in garbology and dishes, you know, that has to me really given me a strong sense of honoring the work of everyone and finding ways to enjoy it and make it fun and, you know, having breaks and really being in it together has been a real joy of being at Holden, you know, and I think we all have found ways to take that home from this place and other places that really honor that too, and it gives you a different sense about work, I think.
Definitely. This place really models, and I think maybe to say a bit about Luther, because I see our time just going. So to move to that section about the Protestant reclaiming, I think reclaiming the Protestant dimension is so critical, and one of the reasons why Holden reflect some of what you're saying, I think does go back to Luther.
And Luther's wife.
And Luther's wife. So one of the things I bumped into was actually not in, it was in a book by a Reform historian, so affected by the Reformation, but more on the Calvin side. But he used in his, in one of his chapters, I stole his words about, called the sanctification of the ordinary. So the Reformed tradition, the Reformation and the Reformed tradition have tried to sanctify the ordinary. So whatever job you have in Holden has potential for grace and the enactment of faith. Luther, let me just, I discovered what a friend I had in Luther by just bumping into some of his work. And we talked a bit about this in the Bible session with Mark when he asked, you know, how do you all define call? How do people define call? And several people reflected, you know, that each person, we all share a call. And I think that really goes to Luther. I think I'm glad you said something about Catherine Van Bora. He could even be called the father of the effort to unite the holy and the mundane. And he had to put his own 16th century principles of religious reformation into action by renouncing his vow of celibacy. But it was really Catherine Van Bora who said, "You're going to marry me." I mean, I think she was the one who pursued marriage. And she was a wonderful, hardworking, straightforward partner who really knew how to hold her own. In some ways, I think their relationship is fascinating itself. They raised a large, boisterous family that included 6 of their own children and 4 orphans. And when I first read Luther's remarks, I was really disarmed. I mean, you probably know better than I what an evocative, provocative, or maybe not, colorful author he is. Off-color, humorous, and I think he's actually, when I reread this passage I'm going to read to you, he is a master of overstatement, you know, to make his point. But it's beautifully done. So here are his words. You have to picture in the back, and this is only one passage of several, that my sticky diapers comes from him, and I don't think I have this in my notes, but you know, he saw stinky diapers as like pearls or diamonds. Just master of overstatement, but he's behind the passage I'm going to read. His adversary stands behind this other received tradition, and it's partly the Greek ideal of reason rising above the body, and the body being a prison to the rational mind, which is so much a part of the early Greek influence on the early Christian tradition. And so this, I'll close with his words, and if people want to stay and talk more, or I'm happy to pick up some of the ideas later, but I'll close with his words. He writes, "When our natural reason takes a look at the married life," so he means this Greek ideal, "she turns her nose and says, 'Alas, must I,'" and this is a really run-on sentence, so here I go, "'Alas, must I rock the baby, wash its diapers, make its bed, smell its stench, stay up nights with it, take care of it when it cries, heal its rashes and sores, and on top of that, care for my wife, provide for her, labor at my trade, take care of this and take care of that, do this and do that, endure this and endure that, and whatever else of bitterness and drudgery married life involves? What should I make a prisoner of myself? What then does Christian faith say to this? It opens its eyes, looks upon all these insignificant, distasteful, and despised duties in the spirit, and is aware that they are all adorned with divine approval, as with the costliest gold and jewels. I confess to thee that I am not worthy to rock the little babe or wash its diapers or to be entrusted with the care of the child and its mother. "Oh, how gladly will I do so, though the duties should be even more insignificant and despised. Neither frost nor heat, neither drudgery nor labor will distress or dissuade me, for I am certain that it is thus pleasing in God's sight." Isn't he something else? The only last thing I would say is maybe a nice connection back to Mark's session, which is that he really, what this was all part of redefining vocation and creating a sense of non-elite openness to the religious life, the life of faith, the life of spirituality, that we're called into every walk of life, and that includes everything from bakers to craftsmen to farmers to peasants and mothers and fathers, and that these are vocations, not simply occupations, but avenues of being more faithful. Any last comments? I mean, I know people need to head to worship, so. It's great to read Luther every once in a while. Do Lutherans do that? Go back to those primary texts? Yeah, I mean, we get, one thing that we do in the academic world is go back to primary texts, and you know, we're always surprised when we do so, because you just think, wow, these are really persuasive, powerful, amazing authors, and they say things well for us. Well, you know, one thing, I think it's no longer up in the VC, but is it Gertrude
Lundholm?
Another thing that, there's some Holden influences pieces in this book, and in the same section where I redeem Martha, I'm also trying to redeem chaos, not to honor fragmentation, but to say sometimes in the midst of chaos. And Gertrude said, and it was posted several years ago when I was here, and passed the peace by saying, "May the peace disturb you." Thinking that peace is not, may it disturb you, and that peace is not sometimes the passive quiescence.
I have preserved you.
Yeah. Yeah, so I think that's another thing to think about, that we sometimes have not understood peace as fully as we ought to. Sometimes Christ's peace can disrupt our lives in positive and scary ways. Well, go in peace.
Thank you.
Was when she died, that family was up.
That was
she died.
Yeah. Not yet.
As for I was probably.
Yes. I may have been a
I don't know. But it made it on this book.
Yeah.
It's easier to see myself. There's so much about the age and the sizing. So
I know, that's the thing. And
so I was in my daughter yesterday.
I'm glad you said something about ambivalence because about family, because I just recently heard, I'm blanking on her last name, I'm pretty sure her first name is Barbara, and she's a pretty famous Catholic ethicist who wrote a book about sexuality that got her in kind of hot water.
Could have been Christine Gudorf. No, that doesn't sound
right.
Right.
Barbara something, but
okay.
Anyways, but she did this whole lecture about family ethics and sexual ethics and stuff, but she started by this like history of family. And if you read Paul, you know, it's very anti-family in a lot of ways. But then she talked about how the Reformation really brought it back.
Right.
But, you know, that was in contradiction to the Catholic understanding. And so in some ways they're doing it because, you know, they want to be different and speak against what the Catholic, you know, which for some great reasons and some maybe not so great reasons, they're saying that the monastic, you know, traditions are just horrible. But anyways, I was like fascinated because I hadn't really like thought of it all together like that.
Yeah,
and to
that
think about
spectrum.
Yeah, what Jesus says, what Paul says. what the, or, you know, traditions, the Hebrew traditions before that, very family focused. But then, like you said, some of the critique in the New Testament is about the patriarchal, you know, family oppression that did really, you know, where some people were breaking out of it in the early church in a really positive way by saying they don't have to get married, they don't have to, you know. So it is, it's just such a mix.
It's a mix, it's such a mix. And it does create, in some ways, what is powerful about the church community is its alternative family in a not literal sense way. But it has created a complexity, I think, in our tradition that you might not see as Judaism, where, like, if you,
it's very family,
it's very family, and there's a beauty to that. If you've ever participated in a Passover, you can see why it's so still located within the family context.
But then there is still the patriarchal issues, which I think are true of that tradition, and also of, you know, what's great about, like, the women and, like, the Acts of the Apostles or whatever, that they're able to, like, live in this new life where they're not. And I think she also, maybe she said this, maybe I'm making it up, but for, you know, homosexual partners too, like, having an alternative to the patriarchal traditional family and saying, like, in the Christian faith, we don't believe it has to be in a certain way, and that God frees us from these types of oppression, you know, oppressive culture, can also be really, you know, freeing too. So trying to hold that all and, you know, see the, but I think just to see the ambivalence is really important for people who don't think about that. You know, you read Paul and then you don't put that together with other texts.